This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Back in the good old days, discussions on revolutions took place in a cafe or in a safe house. But as time progressed, people have discovered a different platform to use when they have discussions on movements or ideas. Activism or movements shifted online, mostly onto social media. People began using hashtags or sharing online petitions or joining Facebook groups aligned to their causes.
But is social media activism akin to real activism? You know, when you go down on the ground and march or have a sit-in and demand for change. It is an important component of activism, no doubt, and an effective rallying tool at that. But does it translate itself to the reality?
BFM 89.9, good morning, I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Baharuddin.
This is In Case You Missed It. This week, we look into activism on social media.
But before that, we have a couple of stories from Asia Calling. Music aids the recovery process of a victim of racial attack in Australia, and call centres in the Philippines are saturated.
For the most part, Australia is a safe place for migrants from Asia. However, there are some rare incidences of racial violence and attacks. Vietnamese international student Minh Dung was unfortunate to be a victim of a brutal racial attack in 2012 in Melbourne, where he was studying. The attack almost left him dead. However, his long road to recovery has been aided by a piano teacher who heard his story and offered to teach him music. Asia Calling's Johnny Blackarley brings us the story from Melbourne.
My name is Minh Dung Yung and I am 25 years old.
Minh moved to Australia as an international student in high school and then went on to study accounting at university. However, in 2012, he was brutally attacked on his way home from work by a group of neo-Nazis. He was kicked, stabbed, and a brick was dropped on his head. Two of the men were later sentenced to long jail terms for the attack.
And it took about more than 6 months to recover all my injuries in the hospital. However, I don't have any front teeth because of the attack.
It took Minh almost 3 years to get compensation to pay for his teeth to be repaired. However, shortly after the attack, a local piano teacher, Adrian De Luca, reached out to Minh, wanting to help.
I was watching TV and Minh's story came on the news, and I thought, this happened so close to where I work that maybe I can get involved somehow to help him. That's what I assumed, and I thought, well, I've got to let him know that Australia cannot be represented by people like this.
The two formed a close friendship, and Adrian began teaching Minh piano in the hope that it would help him express himself and heal from the trauma of the attack.
Minh had never touched the piano in the past, had never touched an instrument in the past. So, well, maybe because he's an accountant, he finds music like a mathematical equation. And at the beginning, everything was very static. Me being Italian, and I exaggerate all my emotions. Slowly, Minh started to show his emotions through the music as well. So the mathematics started dying out, and the soul of the music started, let's say, progressing and shining through.
I popular, I love it because I like challenge. I want to try something. I always try something new. You know that your life is limited, and you need to get up and get something new before until you pass away. Yeah, I want have experience for on off kind of field that I never tried. That's why I feel that interest in when everyone offered me music.
Now, 4 years on from the attack, Ming has graduated from his degree and is applying for his visa to permanently live in Australia. He has performed with Adrian on stage, and while his dream is to still be an accountant, he doesn't want to stop playing music.
And you don't need to talk, and you just use music to tell your story, and it's very special way. I feel like special, like audience listen to my story, but I don't need to tell them. I just play the music, and audience feel and understand my story. I feel that, yeah, I will keep playing until I'm not I cannot survive anymore. Yeah, I will keep continuing my music career.
For Asia Calling, this is Johnny Blakali in Melbourne.
It's really good that Min managed to work through his trauma through music. You know, Hanif, it's this fear and hatred of people who are different from you. People just hate and act out instead of taking time to understand them, to learn about their culture. What did Min do to deserve that attack? Was it just because, what, he isn't white? It's absurd. This whole Reclaim Australia movement. What about the original Australians? You know, the Aboriginals? What about what was done to them? Shouldn't they be the ones running the Reclaim Australia campaign? Hashtag just saying.
I can understand your frustration, Cheryl. For some strange reason, people are not able to even tolerate, let alone have a proper and deeper understanding of one another.
And that's the problem.
Yes, exactly. No negotiation at all. What happened to Min was really unfortunate, but I have to give credit to the way he coped with the pain and the traumatic experience.
I agree.
Yes, music has that intangible quality to somehow better our lives. I think it provided Min with a healthy distraction and a renewed sense of focus. I wish I could start learning how to play music now. The Philippines is the call center capital of the world. It's a $22 billion industry that employs 1.2 million Filipinos. But as Jofel Tosorio finds, the call center industry might have reached a saturation point.
Thank you for calling Nissan. My name is Lauren. Can I have your name? Thank you, John. How can I help you?
This is a typical night in a call center in Manila. A Filipino service representative is patiently giving advice to an American customer regarding car insurance. She's one of the 1.2 million Filipinos employed in the information technology, business process outsourcing, or IT BPO sector. For the last 7 years, Maria Aguilar has been working for an American-owned firm.
We have a rotation schedule, so sometimes I work in the night shift, and sometimes I work in the mid-shift, that would be 1 p.m. to 10 p.m.
Since most clients are from the West, a regular shift is from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. Jobs in the industry vary, from making and receiving calls to making animation and accounting services. Jerry Natrero works for a Canadian company.
Basically, the clients are someone who's dealing with engineering, electric, you know, mechanical kind of thing, like automations, equipments.
The IT BPO industry generated $22 billion in 2015, second to remittances of Filipinos abroad, which was at $25.8 billion. Leon Marasigan is a research specialist at the University of the Philippines. She's finishing her PhD at the University of Amsterdam by looking into the career path of employees in the industry. She explains the division of services.
It is still mainly voice-based work that we're providing. 60% of all businesses that are coming in are voice-based, meaning call center, contact center jobs. And then you have health management, transcription services. That's also becoming quite big in terms of the numbers of firms that are doing that particular kind of function.
The Philippines is called the call center capital of the world after overtaking India 4 years ago. The Filipinos' English language skills and affinity to Western culture make it an attractive destination. But working in a call center can be pretty stressful, admits Joel Contravida.
We expect actually, we have, especially on our kind of account, we have a lot of irate customers or angry customers because we're on the, order releasing. When they receive the item, if it's defective or there's something wrong or lost or missing. So usually the customer will call us and they're so angry about it. So mostly we just try to listen to them at first.
Despite working night shifts and encountering abusive callers, Joel says the salary and benefits are worth it. And call center work can also be home-based. Chini De Cuos works from home doing phone surveys for a Canadian company.
I think it's an answer to unemployment, especially to people, especially for mothers. I'm not a mother. If I am to put it in a context wherein a mother had to work and had to look after her children, then this can be an answer to add up to their income.
Chini is paid $5 per hour, comparable to the daily minimum wage locally. The average starting salary for IT BPO work is $450 a month. The outsourcing industry has been criticized for moving jobs to low-wage countries like the Philippines and India to save costs. But former employee and now insurance agent Ellie Valendez sees the bright side.
The multinational companies like in the US or in Canada or in Switzerland, they go to the Philippines and employ local workforce because it's quite cheaper than the Americans. Pero kung iko-compare mo, kung titingnan mo naman siya dun sa local.
But if you compare it to the local setting where they give a higher salary than local counterparts, then it's not exploitation at all. In fact, it is beneficial to the workforce because they are paid higher and get more benefits.
With more than a million Filipinos graduating every year and with an employment rate hovering at 6.6%, the IT BPO industry provides much-needed jobs. Again, academic Leon Marasigan.
There are many opportunities that the BPO sector are opening up for many workers in the Philippines, both those who are from the unemployed or long unemployed groups of workers and also from the recent graduates who are transitioning from school to work.
Dr. Jana Kleibert, who also did her PhD research on the sector at the University of Amsterdam, says clearly there are some benefits from salaries and income taxes, but that's not the full story.
But if we look beyond that, there's not that much value capturing happening because most firms in the offshore service sector in the Philippines are foreign-owned firms. So a lot of the profits will not necessarily be reinvested in the Philippines, but will be transferred abroad.
Yana says that more support is needed for small and medium businesses at home that export services to global markets. And in the long term, more benefits will come from higher levels of education so Filipinos can take on management roles.
Thank you for calling Martha's Flores. How may I assist you? I'd be happy to take care of your order. May I have your name, please? Randalls, can you spell that for me?
With Ariel Carlos from Manila, Philippines, this is Joe Feltisorio for Asia Calling.
I don't know how to feel about Asia being used as an outsource hub for high-profile companies in the West. Yes, it creates job opportunities to the people here, and they are usually well remunerated. But it still feels like the resources here are being utilized only to fulfill a certain role. Not to say I don't appreciate it, though.
But it's not just saturation that the workers in the call centers need to worry about. It's also the idea that as technology improves, an increasing number of them are likely to have their jobs outsourced to customer service robots. Personally, I hate calling customer service. The experience usually makes me want to tear my hair out. I mean, I'm talking about anger. You just wait. There's so much waiting.
It's not that bad. I mean, granted, you have to go through certain processes and whatnot, but...
And if you know me, I'm really not a patient person. Now, I would much rather chat to a person online via text message. This is so much easier and it's a more pleasant experience. At least so far. Knock on wood. Asia Calling was produced by Kantor Berita Radio 68H in Jakarta. After the break, we look at social media activism and social media movements. Are they effective?
All that in a minute.
I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Baharuddin.
This is In Case You Missed It, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is In Case You Missed It, I'm Cheryl Kaur.
And I'm Hanif Baharuddin.
Hashtag Black Lives Matter.
Hashtag Bursi.
Hashtag Occupy Wall Street.
Hashtag Bring Our Girls Home.
What do all these hashtags have in common? They are all social media movements created to spark discourse and sometimes mobilize individuals. Change doesn't just happen. It's inspired by ideas, thoughts, and beliefs, which in turn inspire movements.
As Emma Goldman, an activist, once said, "No real social change has ever been brought about without a revolution. Revolution is but thought carried into action."
In history, we've seen changes brought about by movements or activism. There's the suffragette movement in the late 19th and early 20th centuries calling for women's rights.
Or the protests against the involvement of the US during the Vietnam War in the 1960s and 70s.
All these movements have one thing in common. People congregating in a physical space and fighting for a common cause, striving for a change.
But movements are no longer limited to just people meeting up in the flesh. It has now evolved. We have a new medium, the internet.
And that's where social media comes in. It works as a forum for people to share articles and contribute to a greater conversation on social issues without having to be in a physical space together.
Hashtags and sympathetic posts flood social media. But how effective is social media activism or social media movements? Do hashtags help? It creates awareness, yes. But what else does it contribute to in the grand scheme of things?
We spoke to Joanne Lim, the Associate Professor of Communications and Media Studies at Monash University. She specialises in new media and public participation in a democracy. Is there a difference between social media activism and a social media movement?
The social media movement is actually a collective, if you look at it, a collective of people who would come together for a cause, for example, if they believe in a cause for social change, environmental change, or indeed political change. It is a sort of initiative that wants to put forward its views, and I think in general that is what activism is about as well. But if you talk about social media activism, then you are actually looking at individual efforts to, say, take on an activist role within a social media movement. For example, if you think you're a member of a social media movement, that you're automatically a social media activist, then one has to question that thought, because in this day and age, there are various forms of activism. There's selectivism, there is hacktivism, and there's clicktivism. So what do all these things mean? It means the extent of how engaged you are, how involved you are in a particular movement. So if, for example, you follow or you like a movement and perhaps you post a comment or two, that doesn't necessarily make you the social media activist. Now, the whole notion of selectivism comes from that thought. It's just a feel-good activity where you follow and you click or you like a page, but you don't necessarily put that into action. It doesn't quite follow through in terms of how it would translate to how you would act offline, for example, in the physical world.
So in other words, it's kind of like a passive thing then.
That's right. That would be how you define selectivism.
How effective is social media activism then, since there are people who passively participate as well?
Social media activism in that sense is effective to an extent of creating awareness. So a lot of young people we speak to, a lot of people who initiate social media movements, for example, they have the initial intention to create awareness. So that would be the first call for action, to actually create awareness, to let people know what's happening, to let people gain access to information, for example, information that perhaps is not readily available offline via the mainstream media, via the news. Subsequently, what comes about is an effort to actually garner following and indeed encourage meaningful engagement. So you see people then encouraging more followers, more likes, for example, and more comments from civil society. And unfortunately, that creates another form of so-called clicktivism, right, where the movement or the organization then adopts a whole ideology of marketing, and clicking becomes the main concern here. So the more clicks, the better. And then they start to monitor and to even measure how many numbers of clicks did this post get, for example, and you get hung up on that, as opposed to actually focusing on whether the message gets out to these people. So in that sense, whether or not social media activism is effective, yes, we do see then that if you talk about Bursay, for example, right, Bursay was initiated online via social media. It was the only platform that was being used. And indeed, you saw the number of people who turned out for the rally. So that would be the extent of, perhaps you would say, the ability for social media to mobilize the masses to go on the streets. That would be a very good example of how online would translate offline. But at the end of the day as well, you then say, does it truly translate to action, all right? Does it translate to, say, the votes that we saw at the end of the day during the elections? And we know the results of that. So in that sense, how effective it is truly depends on how the initiators of the movement actually drive forward this objective of the change that they want to achieve, and how successful they are in engaging the public to truly believe in how they are actually aligning themselves to this movement.
So that's one of the things that skeptics of social media movements have spoken about. They say that this discourse, which is on social media, it often doesn't quite translate or turn into offline movements. Do you agree with that?
Increasingly, we are seeing that, yeah, people are going online and they're doing all sorts of things. You see a million followers and then suddenly they either unfollow or they decide that they're no longer interested. And then as a result, it's true, you don't see that being translated offline. But in many cases, one has to question why that is so and what sort of movements are these, what sort of activist group have seen failures and which other activist groups have seen success. So if you're talking about, say, an environmental group, or you're talking about a group that advocates for social change, most of the time you will find that people who are following these groups would actually go to the streets and do something about it. But I think if you look at political movements, I think people, particularly in this region and more so in this country where there is a heightened sense of culture fear of censorship, in a way, liking a page, for example, puts a fear on people that they are indeed being monitored and watched. It's very visible and they're very aware of that. So in that sense, if you're talking about whether it translates offline in a political sense, perhaps that's more difficult. You wouldn't see people who say things online go out on the streets and say the exact same things. Perhaps they will approach it in a different way. I mean, we've also seen people expressing themselves in alternative ways via very creative forms of calling for social change. So, you know, in terms of satirical means, via online memes, for example, or they go out and they do a flash mob. In terms of that, that would be how Malaysians, for example, would mobilize online, gain following, and then try and infect this change within society.
Let's go on to the platforms that are used. What are the more popular social media platforms for social media activism?
In terms of more popular platforms that are being used for this type of social media activism, you would actually see Twitter being used a lot, Facebook, YouTube, and recently as well, Instagram. Instagram has now come up tops in terms of the most popular platform. A lot of people are also using Snapchat, but particularly for activism alone, I believe YouTube, because there's a lot of sharing of videos. It's all this crowdsourcing for videos. Twitter, because it's short, it's brief, and information gets passed around very quickly. And of course, Facebook, I mean, we're still a Facebook country.
social media, like you said, it's a forum for people to share articles, to contribute to a greater conversation on social issues.
Yeah.
For example, you see all these hashtags like the hashtag Black Lives Matter, hashtag Nothing to Hide, hashtag Respect My PM, or there are even online petitions or Facebook groups. Now, these all create awareness, yes, but what does it contribute to?
At large, it all contributes to this notion of participatory culture. And this is a growing culture, a growing trend in the country and the nation particularly, which embraces technology, globalization, and indeed this whole social media phenomenon. This whole participatory culture is about wanting to be involved and wanting to be valued for your contribution as well. So it's actually a sense of people wanting to make a change and being able to, say, sign up for an online campaign, for example, being able to sign an internet petition, join a community organization online, contributing to the organization's efforts, for example, even copying and pasting of social network statuses or messages, or altering one's personal data or avatar on social network services. I mean, we see people changing their Facebook profiles to black and yellow and rainbow and whatnot, right? And so all of that adds to this sense of being involved. And in this age of, we're talking about the fourth industrial revolution, it's a digital revolution, yeah? And so people want to be engaged. They want to feel that they are indeed making a change in society. They are doing their part. But at the same time, they need to continuously question this effort. To what extent does it go in terms of signing an internet petition, for example? What does it mean, right?
Yeah, because we don't really think about it sometimes. It just pops up on our Facebook page or it pops up on Twitter and all that. We click the link, we sign up, we do whatever it is. But some people don't really think about their actions or think about what they've actually clicked on.
Exactly. And then that leads to selectivism. I mean, it's very easy to like and share and tweet, but what does it lead to? What does it mean, right? So meaningful participation, meaningful engagement is indeed what we are questioning right now.
Actually, that goes on to my next point, which is that popular social media-driven movements, they seem to be short-term moments. Do you agree with that?
Social media is very fleeting, indeed. A lot of news comes in and out very quickly. We have contradictions. We have a saturation of information online. And so with that, you see that the whole notion of fleetingness, which is exactly is the digital age, right? We're defining this digital age as being very fleeting. And so with that as well, we see people, for example, being engaged in a social movement one day, and the next day they feel, okay, I think I'm not so interested anymore. I'm just going to unfollow or leave the group, for example. And they make such decisions overnight. And so again, it is as fleeting as that, which is dangerous, yeah? Because it boils down to the question of what are you actually doing it for? And, you know, are you actually affecting change by fleetingly joining a group and leaving it, for example?
Do social media movements often result in concrete institutional change?
Okay, so in terms of Malaysia, I think we hardly see that, although we do see very strong social movements, groups actually coming forward and signing petitions and putting up a list, for example, of possible policy changes and presenting it to, say, the powers that be or the people who actually hold office and could make decisions. Now, it's gone to that extent, certainly, to put pressure on the government, if you like. But what you're also seeing is a sort of gatekeeping that comes from the side of the people. So all along we've talked about sort of mainstream media being the gatekeepers of information that circulates amongst society. But now we're seeing that via these movements, people are crowdsourcing for information. They're putting information online. And in terms of the movements and what they stand for, it has made it perhaps more organized. And so information that then gets circulated back to the people. In terms of internationally, if you look at, say, the US and South Korea, for example, mobile media, social media has actually managed to illuminate much of what is known about the positive effects of social media on offline civic and political participation, actually. And to a certain extent, if you talk about keyboard warriors, in Malaysia there are many sort of keyboard warriors and we engage in that, whereas in South Africa they are called urban warriors and they align themselves to a sort of initiative to assist with the HIV and the AIDS campaign in South Africa. And this has actually affected change within the system and within how the country or the government manages HIV and AIDS in the country. So in that sense, there are instances where social media has been effective to that extent.
Are social media engagements a new way for public participation in a democracy?
I believe you talk about an authoritarian democracy, then certainly social media is indeed a very, very important platform. Otherwise, we're talking about voices that perhaps would not be heard, you know, offline or perhaps within mainstream media. So it is a very crucial platform for people in terms of the marginalized, the discriminated, the subaltern, to actually voice and speak out their views to get themselves heard. And it's also a good way for civil society to access information that's not readily available to them. I think the one thing here to point out is whether or not civil society is educated enough to verify these sources of information. And the one thing is about whether or not we know how to verify these sources of information. And the other is about actually intentionally wanting to make fake news viral. And that's the other thing to also consider. I mean, in this day and age, when we consciously know that a particular news piece or a particular report is fake, why is it that we still go on and spread this news and share it and tweet it, right? I think civil society, basically netizens, users of the internet and social media, they have to be aware that their role is no longer just using social media. And I would like to bring up this term called producer, all right, where you are actually a producer spelled with an S, yeah, P-R-O-D-U-S-E-R, where you're both a producer at the same time as you are a user. So you are producing news. You're not just consuming and reading this sort of information. But as you share and tweet and comment, what you're doing is you're producing new forms of information. And well, we go to the extent of creating videos as well, right? I mean, now it's also a very popular trend. So video blogging, podcasting, our thoughts and our ideas. I think we need to also know that such things can affect the way people think and perceive particular events, phenomenon, a news story, and that these are very significant elements within the whole scheme of social media information that's being circulated.
So what is the appeal of social media activism?
I think the appeal of social media activism is primarily engagement. Engagement with community. And we're talking about a sense of belonging. We're talking about connectivity, being able to connect with people who are like-minded, perhaps, being able to engage in discussions, in debate with people who don't share the same views with you. So again, it's this new level of communication, yeah, this new opportunity and possibility for exchanges that are, in a way, you're talking about a freedom that perhaps will not exist offline, yeah? I mean, we're talking about people who comment either anonymously or, you know, using their own profile. But in that sense, there is still a means for communicating and then connecting with people who can resolve an issue, for example, connecting with a community who wants to affect social change. So in that sense, that truly matters. And finally, as I've mentioned earlier, this notion of the sense of belonging to a community, of belonging particularly to a group of followers who want to move forward and do something, and who share an interest, perhaps to fundraise, to lobby, build a community. In that sense, we're talking about a sense of belonging where people then can also interchangeably take on lead roles as well. So if you're talking about social media movements, right, most of the time you don't see a leader. Although, yes, there may be initiators and administrators.
Yeah.
The beauty of social media movements is that actually anyone can truly take a lead role, actually just belong to that community and everybody works together. That's the whole notion of actually crowdsourcing and sort of coming together and building this community where you then can organize and mobilize, for example, public protests for advocacy around various areas like education, anti-crime, corruption, pro-sex education, for example, and all these various areas that affect society.
Is social media activism exclusive in its demographic? For example, favoring the young and the technologically savvy, but marginalizing the older, less technology-inclined people?
Social media, I believe, is not limited to the young, actually. And if you talk about youth and how you define youth, of course, if you look at the statistics, it shows that people between the age of 18 to say 33 or 35, the youth category, are indeed the most active users of social media. But that doesn't constrain it to that extent in terms of who are necessarily involved in these movements and who participates in these activist social media initiatives. We can actually see that there is no difference between gender, that's one thing, but also in terms of age, and it depends on how you define youth, right? Because as you can see as well, in terms of who attends the rallies, it's not just the young people, right? You see the young and old at the same time. And we see a lot of the elderly as well now being engaged within the social media platforms. If you reflect on Benedict Anderson's statement on youth, where he explains the nationalist movements in post-colonial states in his book Imagined Communities, then it becomes very relevant in terms of how we should perceive the notion of youth participation. And what it truly means and what he says is actually the fact that the idea of youth has no necessary connection between language, age, class, and status. So in terms of youthfulness, I believe that comes from a notion of being young at heart. So we're talking about dynamic beings, we're talking about activist notions, we're talking about even rebelliousness. And that's not necessarily then confined to the young people. And you can see that taking place in our rallies as well, where you can see the young and old coming together and participating for a particular cause.
So we've talked about social media activism and social media movements, but I'd like to know, what is the perception of it like here in Malaysia among Malaysians?
So when I first started to do this research on social media activism, and this was in 2011, activism was actually seen as a taboo word amongst young people in our society. So I spoke to young people in social movements and those who were actively participating in social, civic, political engagement organizations. And they would actually want to detach themselves from the whole idea of activism. They would call themselves advocates. They would call themselves responsible rakyats, responsible citizens. Yeah. In many ways, they said, no, activism, that's taboo. It's scorned upon. It's seen as a very negative thing. Following from that, we then saw the Bersih rallies. We then saw Black 505. We even saw DINAS, the environment movement, coming in. And then slowly it picked momentum, yeah? And young people now, as we talk about this in 2016, they are very actively engaged in activism, and they would very explicitly also make it known that they are very passionate about this particular movement and that particular movement, and they use the word activism freely. So we see a change of mindset here in terms of how a word that was taboo in the past is now seen as perhaps something that is very, very positive in society, because, again, it's all about now making a difference, making a change in society. But then again, that leads us back to the question of, is it truly activism or is it slacktivism?
That was Joanne Lim, Associate Professor of Communications and Media Studies at Monash University. This morning's show was produced by Hanif Baharudin and me, Cheryl Kaur.
I hope it's been food for thought. And remember, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance.
This is, in case you missed it, BFM 89.9, the Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the Business Station.